January is when we recommit to the habits that support our health and well-being. And naturally, we start looking at what can support those goals, including supplements. But choosing the right supplements can be confusing, because not only are there so many brands out there, the supplement industry itself is a low-trust category. It's lightly regulated, products are easy to make, and companies don't even have to list everything on their label. Now, there's Momentous. They've become the high-trust brand in a low-trust category. They weren't satisfied with the industry standard, so they built the Momentous Standard, their commitment to doing things the right way, not the easy way. Momentous sources the highest quality ingredients on the planet. Their whey protein comes from grass-fed European dairy cows. Their creatine uses the purest form of creatine monohydrate, and every formula is made with clinically backed, highly bioavailable nutrients, with no fillers and no artificial sweeteners. Right now, Momentous is offering listeners up to 35% off your first order with promo code AudioBoom. Head to livemomentous.com and use promo code AudioBoom for up to 35% off your first order. That's livemomentous.com, promo code AudioBoom.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, and welcome back to Comics Corner. I'm your host, Connor, joined again by Harry.
Hello.
And as promised last time, we are discussing Marv Wolfman and George Perez's Crisis on Infinite Earths, as you'll see with the fantastic backdrop behind us, with the looming anti-monitor right in the middle. Now, for those who don't know, Crisis on Infinite Earths was the 12-part maxi-series that helped DC celebrate its 50th anniversary, and was the means by which, in-universe, they used an annual event to condense all of their multiverse continuity down to one single chronological Earth that has cohesiveness and makes a degree of sense. There were still issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my questions with it, how necessary was that to do that? How, like, before Crisis on Infinite Earth, how difficult and confusing was it actually to keep a track of the DC universe if you were reading along with it? Or was it basically as complicated as it would be to just keep up with all the different series that they would have running afterwards anyway?
Okay, those are two different questions.
Oh, okay. Right?
So,
all right.
Unbelievably complicated.
Oh, all right, okay.
Because as we covered in our two-part history of comics, which you should watch, by the way, remember that this was the same Batman who was fighting vampires and killing people in the 30s, then palling around on the Zur-En-Arr Earth and fighting robots in the 40s, 50s, and then somehow still the same age in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, despite going through two Robins and a bunch of failed relationships.
Is this not how they explain it with the Earth 1 and Earth 2 Batman? The same way that, from what I could tell from reading this, Earth 2 Superman is the Superman from the original action comics, and Earth 1 Superman is just the Superman in the more recent series up to that point?
Kind of, not really. That's the sort of invention in the 70s when they introduced the All-Star Brigade, All-Star Squadron, and then there's still some stuff that Batman will reference in Earth 1 continuity that should be Earth 2, and then Earth 2 Batman has Dick Grayson grown up, who's now an adult Robin, and a daughter who's Helena Wayne Huntress.
So what you're telling me is the writers had no clue.
They had zero idea. They didn't know. Now, the second part of your question is,
all right,
was it as complicated as trying to keep up with what's happened since Crisis? Yes. Yes. Because they bugged it up. Because they kept doing Crises.
Well, yeah, I know. This led to Identity Crisis, which feels like it doesn't need the Crisis title. It feels, if you're going to have it be a quadrilogy of Crisis titles, Identity Crisis is very much the odd man out. Because
Quintilogy. Zero Hour Crisis in Time was 1944, because they realized, oh, bugger, we didn't stop time travel, did we?
Oh, okay.
And there's like five Hawkmen at once.
All right, okay. That muddies the waters even further. But yeah, Identity Crisis is the odd man out because it's not about some universe-quaking, multidimensional space story. It's a mystery series, which I, once again, you and I, who have made a bit of a habit on this of going, you know, this beloved classic story that everybody has fond memories of, actually quite bad. We turn around and go, you know the one everyone hates? Great. That's the best one so far. But Infinite Crisis, I remember reading when I was a teenager. And it was very confused. Very, very confused. And then I decided to follow up with Final Crisis and even more confused. And at that point, I was just like, I'm not going to bother trying to understand these big maxi series anymore.
Infinite Crisis only makes sense if you read like all the tie-ins, including Day of Vengeance and what's the other one? Villains United and all of this other ancillary
stuff.
And
I assume as well, if you make sure to have paid minute attention to even the smallest panels in Crisis on Infinite Earths, then you make sure to, like, maybe then you'll understand it a bit better as well.
No, because it's kind of infamous for creating the Red Skies crossover, which I referenced last time.
Oh, okay.
Which essentially means that when the sky turns red in Crisis on Infinite Earths, that happens in all of the DC books, because almost every DC book got its continuity reset. But some of the writers just didn't care. Like, some of the writers had the characters go, oh my God, the sky's turning red. Anyway, back to chasing the penguin. Like, that was it. Was that what Batman was up to?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's my other question, is that this was the big universe reset where they take all of the multiverses and condense them down into a single universe with a single continuity. But the story takes place in real time, and also the story was released issue to issue over the course of almost a year. What the hell was going on with all of the other stories in all of the other comic single issues that were going on? Did they just stop or did they carry on? How do you, like, if you're a writer and all of a sudden you just get it thrown on your desk that, by the way, that we're resetting the entire universe next June, and you've got like plans for long form stories that are going to carry on, you've been setting things up, what do you do?
Leave your book, as Marv Wolfman soon found out, because a lot of writers and artists weren't very happy with it.
Well, yeah, because that's the thing, is I opened this very nice Eagle Moss collection edition of
out of print.
Yes, and one of the first things it says is that Marv Wolfman, he wanted to write a story where it brings all of the characters together in one big story. And it doesn't mention anything to do with the multiverse reset, restarting the continuity or anything like that.
It was originally called The History of the DC Universe, which was then the follow-up two-parter series in 1987, which he did as a sequel. He reused the title for it.
Oh, okay. So, and it also that he spent like 5 years researching all of the characters in the DC Universe so he could make sure that everybody is fit into the story properly and that everybody gets their moment to shine. And I've got to say, I had some major, this might just be because I read it all in one day, I had some major problems reading through this story because it is a slog.
Okay, it does require like multiple read-throughs, I think, and to be steeped in continuity. In terms of our reputation for controversial takes, I will say today, finally, after quite a few months, we are discussing two books that I actually really like, particularly Legends. I think Legends is great.
Legends, I'm going to agree with you. I'm really enjoying it. Crisis, we might have butt heads here a little bit, but let's carry on.
So to outline some of the context of Crisis. So it's written by Marv Wolfman and co-plotted and penciled by George Perez, RIP. Now the pair began working at DC together because they relaunched Teen Titans with the new Teen Titans in 1982. I think that's the correct year, and I should get that right because I absolutely love that series. And it's of note because that became the top-selling DC book for multiple years. When every other comic was selling like 60,000 to 90,000 copies a month, New Teen Titans was selling between 200,000 and 400,000 and actually out-competing Uncanny X-Men, which was the top-selling title at the time. So they were battling Chris Claremont for like top spot on all of the comic-selling charts.
Can you imagine if the comics industry was getting those kinds of numbers today?
Yeah, well, they could just not be gay race communists and actively insulting their readership.
Well, just to butt in very, very quickly, to interrupt, on that subject, I was in Manchester over the weekend and I went to, there are two comic book shops in Manchester. They're both incredibly gay, but they're comic book shops. So I put my head through. One's Traveling Man and one is Forbidden Planet. And my God, you will notice when you go in there, the Western comic section in most comic book shops these days is a shelf. It's a shelf. Forbidden Planet there used to have an entire wall that was all of the latest Marvel and DC omnibus that had been released, and then loads of different shelves across the second half of the shop that were covered in hardcovers, trade paperbacks, and a big wall covered in all of the newest single issues. That's gone. Most of those walls are now covered in Funko Pops. Oh boy, amazing. There's two or three shelves with some Western comics, and Marvel and DC take up maybe a shelf and a half, and the rest is Image and Dark Horse. The rest of the shop is manga. Same with Traveling Man. They've got a wall where they've got two shelves that are split pretty finely with DC, Marvel, Image, Dark Horse. The entire rest of the shop is either models or manga. Manga has overtaken it to such a ridiculous degree. And I wonder if the gay boys running Traveling Man, it's got pride flags, it's got trans flags, it's got non-binary flags in there. They know what they're doing. If they put all of these up, I wonder if they ever think to themselves, if they ponder why it is that all of the manga, which doesn't include any of that rubbish, is outselling all of the Western comics, which do include all of that. Why aren't we stocking single issues of gay Batman anymore? Why aren't we stocking single issues of Superman's gay son anymore? Anyway, pride flags.
Hans, are we the baddies?
Yeah. Right. Do these cross people's minds?
I really don't think so. Or if it does, it's in a very mute way because the entire project of pride is to suppress the screaming conscience of the person adhering to it by making everyone around them affirm themselves. And it's really sad as well because not that modern comics are anything of value, not anything since 2018 has been all particularly of note, but after Crisis, a kind of reinvigoration of the golden age happened with DC because you had loads of great creators really impassioned about the lost but not forgotten continuity of the characters, came along to revitalize titles like George Perez on Wonder Woman, Wolfman and Perez still on Teen Titans, John Byrne on Superman. You had Batman Year One created by Frank Miller immediately after Crisis happened. So you had some really great stories.
I love Year One. That's one of my all-time favorite Batman stories. And I can go back to that every time and go, yep, still as good as I remember.
Yeah, and that was the spirit of Crisis, which I think even though there are some spotty moments in its storytelling, especially considering it was meant to be 10 issues and they dragged it out to 12.
Oh, it drags!
It has a bit of a Jason Voorhees of where he just won't stay down. But anyway, point being, there is a funny story about Marv Wolfman as well. So Marv Wolfman has had a massive impact on the entire comics industry because he accidentally caused creators to start getting credited for comic books. So it's because of his surname, his very unorthodox surname, right? Due to the Comics Code Authority, which we spoke about in the History of Comics series, depictions of things like vampires, ghosts, and werewolves were prohibited. So Jerry Conway, who worked at Marvel and DC in January 1970, was writing a story for House of Secrets number 83. And he wanted the main character, Abel, so Cain and Abel have House of Secrets, House of Mystery. I think it's in Neil Gaiman's Sandman, if I'm correct.
It's been a while since I've read Sandman.
It's probably wise. The narrator, Abel, wanted to say he heard a story from a wandering wolfman. They were going to talk about werewolves. But instead, he put Wolfman, spelling it with Wolfman's name. And so to get away with it, he thought, I have to credit him for the story on the next page. So it's written by Marv Wolfman, is emblazoned on the page. And every creator in that book started going, hang on a minute, if he's getting a credit, why don't I get credits? And so that became the default norm for most books to start crediting their writers, artists, colorists, inkers, and editors.
So in the older issues, would you just not get... Because in this, for instance, or Legends, you get the little panel at the bottom of a splash page that says, written by, inked by, drawn by. Was that just not in those older issues?
Often not in DC. It was commonly in Marvel because Stan Lee used to make up like fantastic nicknames. Like Jack the King Kirby came from Stan Lee crediting his artists. But in DC, wasn't very common. Like lots of the issues just went uncredited. Especially think about the older Batman issues where it was Batman was created by Bob Kane and nobody else.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose that does explain it because I have gone back through some old issues of comics in the past and been confused as, wait, who wrote this? Who drew this? What's going on? I'm so confused.
Yeah, quite. And I'm glad the creators now do get proper credit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Wolfman, Neil Adams have done great stuff.
And now in the modern comic era, we know who to blame.
Quite. Tom King. So it was announced at New York Comic Convention in 1981. And as I said, it was originally titled The History of the DC Universe, but it became Crisis on Infinite Earths to condense the entire and confusing DC multiverse down to one cohesive continuity to give a new jumping on point for brand new readers. And it worked because the John Byrne Man of Steel run, the Frank Miller's Batman run, Wonder Woman all saw the sales tick up because they were much easier to get involved.
And these are all now considered when people look back on the 80s comic industry as being classics of their time, or at least certainly like series that you have to check out.
Yes, they're the seminal particular starting points for many of the characters, and they're indistinct from continuity. It wasn't the first Crisis, though, and this is something that we mentioned before. So there were a few crises, they actually bore that name throughout DC history. There was Flash of Two Worlds, So that was Flash 123, first time the multiverse was acknowledged, Jay Garrick and Barry Allen meeting, and they were comic book characters in each other's respective realities. Then Justice League of America 21 and 22 was Crisis on Earth 1, which established that Earth 2 had the Justice Society and Earth 1 had the Justice League. There were annual crossovers between the JSA and the JLA after that. And then there was Crisis on Earth Prime, not long before this, which united the Justice League, the Justice Society of America, and the All-Star Squadron to fight, I think it was Earth 3's crime syndicate and Pedegaton or something like that.
So were the crises not only universe-wide crossovers, but also consistently attempts to streamline and clarify things?
They were
the
more like annual fun team-ups across one or two titles. So you'd have like two issues of Justice League, two issues of Justice Society, and you'd read one, then the other, run one, then the other. It would run for 2 months, and it would be a once-a-year fun thing. It wasn't, let's kill half the DC universe at once. Which, ambitious, I'll certainly give them that. And then DC Comics Presents 78, which Wolfman wrote, was a lead straight into Crisis on Infinite Earths. He also wrote DC Comics Present Annual 1. Sorry, I think he only wrote the annual, which was Crisis on Three Earths, which had all of the Supermen teaming up, as they do here, because you've now got Earth 2 Superman, Earth 1 Superman, and Alexander Luthor Jr. from Earth 3. So you've got a lot of characters to juggle with the same names as well, which makes this... Yeah. Quite confusing to read the
first
time.
I do think the art helps differentiate it, the way that Earth 2 Superman, just having him be a little bit bulkier with the white strips of hair around his ears, helps to differentiate. So George Perez did a good job in visually differentiating the characters.
Wolfman and Perez were experts at team books, and so he could create a very crowded scene or splash page with 50 heroes there, and you could easily pick out which one is which. And you could probably name them all if you had sufficient level of
continuity. If you have the encyclopedic knowledge that Wolfman, apparently according to this intro, made sure that he had before going into it.
I certainly will credit him with that. Now, leading up to this as well, he'd created the character of the Monitor, who's the central power broker on the side of the heroes, but through the last few years of DC, he was financing all of the villains, so it got quite confusing. And he first conceived the Monitor, Wolfman said when he'd written this, about 18 years ago, and he called him the Librarian because he didn't have a very good sense of names, he said, and he wanted someone to finance all the villains. But then it's revealed, per a conversation between Monitor and Harbinger in the comic, that he was doing so to test which heroes and which villains were optimum to put together as a team to defeat his counterpart, the Anti-Monitor, when he knew inevitably he would return and try and destroy the multiverse. But Monitor had shown up in things like New Teen Titans 21, which is his first debut, which Wolfman and Perez both wrote. They roped him into a few Green Lantern issues, 173 through 178, and then Batman the Outsiders 14 and 15, where behind the scenes he's pulling the strings and making life difficult for the heroes, but it's some sort of crucible to ensure that the people he has on side are adequate to fight them. And the deaths this produces, among them, there's quite a few, but some of the notable ones are, of course, the Anti-Monitor, destroyed by Earth 2 Superman, but then resurrected in Blackest Night, and also Sinestro Corps War by Green Lantern. There's something on Jeff Johns later.
This is the guy you want to bring back to life. I'm sure it makes sense in the story,
Basically, because the Anti-Monitor controls the antimatter universe, in order to get Yellow Lantern rings, Sinestro needed the Thunderers who work for the Anti-Monitor. So he resurrected the Anti-Monitor to command their loyalty and folded him into the Sinestro Corps War. But then he gets killed again, but then Necron of the Black Lanterns brings him back and uses his body as a Black Lantern power battery. Yeah, quite.
I'm sorry.
I don't blame you. Geoff Johns' Green Lantern is a good run, though. So Dove, Don Hall dies, is replaced by Dawn, who's the female Hall eventually. Matt Hagen's Clayface dies, which makes it really confusing for Batman continuity.
One thing that I did pick up that there's about four or five pages dedicated to, and then is dropped, is that Wildcat becomes paralyzed from the legs, from the waist down, and then LaToya Montez, I think her name is.
Yolanda, I think it is.
Yolanda, yeah. American black woman name.
She's Hispanic.
Still. becomes Wildcat instead, and an issue ends on that, like it's some big reveal, like it's a big cliffhanger, she's going to be so important, and then she shows up in maybe two or three more panels in the rest of the story.
Yeah, she gets killed off in 1994 in an obscure book, because if you ever played the Telltale games, you know when you make the wrong decision in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says, and everyone disliked that? That was basically the attitude to crippling Ted Grant and then replacing him with Yolanda, because nobody cared for that legacy character. It wasn't a good decision.
Yeah.
One legacy character people did like is actually Wally West, because he takes over as the Flash, because Barry Allen dies. He dies. He does not disappear into the Speed Force, Grant fucking Morrison, okay? Because that was the retcon in Final Crisis. In this, you see him disintegrate into a skeleton, and he loses his costume. And then in Final Crisis, Barry pops out the Speed Force, fully clothed, like, Wally, take my hand. No, you were dead. Wolfman said you were dead in an interview he did last year. Ridiculous. No, not having it. And then Huntress, the crime syndicate, Julia, as Alfred's daughter, disappears. Solovar, Supergirl of Earth One. There are
Alfred had a daughter?
Yeah, Julia Pennyworth, yes.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Pre-Crisis Batman continuity. All of these people get eliminated by Crisis on Infinite Earths. You can kind of see the necessity to condense it down a little bit. Also, Superman, Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, Captain Atom, and a bunch of other characters were rewritten and reincorporated into the DC universe, with Wonder Woman now showing up midway through DC's history. Contentious decision to do so, but there you go.
Yeah. Also, I've got to say, I was under the impression, I read this when I was a teenager, so I'd forgotten most of the story of it and how it led into the rest of the DC universe continuity-wise going forward. I was given the impression, certainly by Grant Morrison's Animal Man run, which we covered last time, and from my own impressions of the other series that we'd looked at that related to post-crisis DC, that all of the characters, except for Psycho Pirate, didn't remember the events of Crisis. But at the end of this, it seems that the characters who were involved at the Dawn of Time incident, where they go to confront the Anti-Monitor at the Dawn of Time, everybody, and there was quite a few, probably about 100, if not slightly more, heroes who went to confront him, all of them have memories of the pre-Crisis multiversal continuity, which is why Earth 2 Superman and Earth 1 Superman can meet up and discuss how they remember it. And Jay Garrick, they can go to visit him and he remembers it, but his wife doesn't remember it. But I was under the impression that all of their memories were reset except for Psycho Pirate. So is that just a part of this plot that was kind of discarded? Because at the beginning of Legends, Wally West references the events of Crisis. So the continuity, I'm confused.
Valid point. Basically, he had intended for all of the heroes from the Dawn of Time to remember the continuity from before so they could retain some of their friendships and relationships. But then in some of the reboots that is forgotten, for example, Batman and Superman get reintroduced, and for the next few years of continuity, they act like they've only just met rather than be friends for a decade.
So that was more of a fault of the people following up this series.
Definitely. Animal Man was not part of the heroes that were the Dawn of Time, I believe. So that's why the contradictions start breaking his continuity, and that's why Grant Morrison wanted to play with that, because he's part of a group of heroes along with Dolphin and Adam Strange, who encounter Brainiac later on and help involve Darkseid in this. So I think he was outside of that hero group. They didn't get invited to the party. None of the villains remember except for Psycho Pirate, and none of the civilians who are on the New Earth remember aside from Psycho Pirate. But then this is inconsistently played with. Like, sometimes the spouses of superheroes will reference the Crisis as if they know of it firsthand, but not that they were told of it secondhand. So because characters get chopped and changed between writers and editorial teams, these details get forgotten. Essentially, it was intended to be a consistent streamlining, didn't always pan out that way, because creatives do cock up pretty often. The other interesting thing that this does as well, folds all the Charlton characters into the mainline DC universe, much to the shit-eating grin of Alan Moore, who was about to use them and kill them all off in Watchmen. Hence, he had to make all of their analogs. And that's why when all the Charlton characters come along, you see, for example, the Question and Blue Beetle flying around in the bug. That looks exactly like Night Owl and Rorschach. It's because they were going to be used together, and Alan Moore was like, Well, thank you for scuppering all those plans. I guess I've got to be creative for once and invent brand new characters to then immediately defile. I hate Watchmen. We'll explain why in another time. Also, the reason that we're covering it, it's not just because I enjoy these, is because for once I thought I'd do a wholesome series of comics. And there's an underlying, like, late stage Cold War conservatism and a very strong strain of Christianity and existentialism in both of these, particularly Legends. And so good to like nail down the ethic. So, start with issue 1. As you said, this story is situated in a specific place and time. It says explicitly, I think it's the first couple of pages, that it takes place in July 1985. Now, for continuity nerds like me, that's great, because that means you can date almost exactly when Batman became Batman, when Superman became Superman. So, by my count, Frank Miller's Year One and John Byrne's A Man of Steel, retroactively, now take place in 1975. And I say this because Dick Grayson becomes Robin in about Year 3 or 4 of Batman's history in Dark Victory. And he becomes Robin at age 13. And Dick Grayson from Earth 2 in this visits, I believe it's a grave, and then he realizes that Nightwing in this universe, he goes by Nightwing, Dick Grayson, is 19. So that's got to be a 6-year gap at least that Robin was Robin until he led up to Nightwing. So there's got to be 6 years deducted from 1984, 1985. So that means that 1975 is the start point when Batman and Superman arrive on the scene for the first time. So that gives a specific date. And I know that's really petty, but I really like that. Okay, so it opens with Pariah, who's a guy who accidentally believes that he engineered the collapse of his own world by experimenting with antimatter because he was a great scientist. And then he was trying to look into the multiverse and he thinks he unleashed the anti-monitor. He's been damned to be the kind of herald of the anti-monitor's arrival, similar to like Silver Surfer and Galactus. And he shows up as Earth 3 has been destroyed by a big white wave of light, the antimatter wave that's been sent by the anti-monitor. He's been put in this role by the monitor as a means of recompense for his scientific hubris. And he sees that the crime syndicate are being killed and they're infighting, and that Alexander Luthor Sr. and his wife, Lois Lane, send their son, Alexander Luthor Jr., off to Earth 1 so that he can survive and herald a warning to the heroes there so they can save their Earth. Very reminiscent of the original Superman story of Lara and Jor-El sending their son off from Krypton to Earth as Krypton's about to explode. So the monitor sends out Lila, who's a woman that he rescued when she was an orphan at sea. I can't remember the exact
origin. Yeah, she was in some kind of shipwreck. She was holding onto a piece of driftwood and he scooped her up and looked after her.
Yes, quite. He turns her into Harbinger and he has her go around and collect the various heroes that he's been training up by financing their villains and putting them through a crucible and even recruit some villains in there. I think he uses Psycho Pirate to convince Killer Frost to stop fighting Firestorm and actually fall in love with them in sense. And in typical Wolfman and Perez fashion, as per New Teen Titans, there's a lot of innuendo in this book.
Yeah, well, that was something I was wondering about. Well, one, it's not just Psycho Pirate, it's also Simon.
Yes.
P-S-I-M-O-N.
Of the Fearsome Five, yes.
Yes, but Psycho Pirate is only recruited after it's shown that Harbinger has been possessed by either the Anti-Monitor or one of the Shadows, the Thunderers of the Anti-Monitor. And then obviously Psycho Pirate is kidnapped by the Anti-Monitor and brought on side so that he can try and control people's emotions. So later on in the story, you get the crowds of people trying to run into the antimatter waves so that they will just erase themselves out of existence. So I thought, because she was already on her way to get, Arian?
Yes, the Atlantean sorcerer.
And then she turns around to go get Psycho Pirate. So I was wondering, was it that the Anti-Monitor was actually the one after Psycho Pirate and Monitor just went along with it because it kind of folded into his plans anyway?
I wouldn't be shocked. I think he would probably have allowed Harbinger to give
the Monitor allows...
That makes sense.
The Monitor allows Anti-Monitor to do quite a few things because the Anti-Monitor says explicitly that he recruited Psycho Pirate. He could have gotten a few other people who can manipulate emotions, but it seems that Psycho Pirate being, one, vulnerable because he was in prison, which made him easy to recruit, and two, just a weak and pathetic, easily manipulated person seemed to be the best one for the job.
Yeah, and I think he would have allowed a little bit of leeway with risk regarding that because he knew that he was going to be killed anyway because his essence had to power the tuning forks that brought the Earths together. Very loose cosmology going on here, but I think your reading of that is right.
Yeah, let's not try and take any of the science mumbo jumbo talk in these kinds of series seriously.
Yeah, quite. You've just got to understand that there is an internal
logic to it. The alpha waves are combining with the protons to create antimatter. What's going on?
Yeah, quite.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
60% of top distributors run on Epicor Profit 21. It's ERP built for distribution, enhanced with agentic AI that doesn't just inform, but acts. Optimizing inventory, streamlining purchasing, and making every day easier. Don't play catch up. Visit epicor.com/win.
Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in 1. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week.
Save